Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum. And tonight's event will be sponsored by the California Historical Society, and it's also a program in our Good Lit series, which is underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. So tonight, to introduce both the speaker and the moderator, we have the Executive Director of the California Historical Society, Dr. Anthea Hartig, who will introduce the lecture and also tell you a little bit about the California Historical Society.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, George, and thank you, everyone, at the Commonwealth Club. It's a true honor and pleasure to be with you tonight, and thank you to our members at the California Historical Society. As you might guess, there's some overlap, so we were thrilled that so many of you could join us tonight, so thank you. And it's beautiful to be in your new space, so congratulations to all of you at the Commonwealth Club for creating this. We share with all of you a passion for conversation, for civility, for learning, in order to create a more informed and just future. And so I know we're in for a big treat tonight. If you want to learn more about the California Historical Society, please talk to me afterwards or pick up one of these handy new brochures we created that you get also postcards from our collection. We pick some sites you might know, you know, Golden Gate Bridge, Yosemite, that, like the Brown family, of course, are icons of our California experience. And we're also opening a new show next Friday called Boomtowns, which pulls from our remarkable millions of historic photographs and takes a look at 100 years of development in San Francisco and Los Angeles through the lenses of photographers, some whom you'll know and some to whom you'll be introduced, hopefully when you come see the show. It's a true pleasure for me to introduce Miriam Powell, who's an insightful and even artisanal historian. I know you don't get that every introduction. Her work has inspired so many of us to think both about the men and women who have made California and the West and who continue to shape this remarkable nation state. Miriam is a Pulitzer Prize-winning editor at Newsday in the LA Times. She returns, as George said, to the Commonwealth Club after her remarkable book, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, which was the winner of the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Book Award. Her awards are many. Her vitae is long. But tonight, as you know, she's here to speak about her latest book, which I have been plowing through with zest and zeal and trying to read it in the daytime, so I'm completely alert for it. The Browns of California, the Family Dynasty that Transformed the State and Shaped a Nation. And I know she joins me in welcoming a number of the Brown family here tonight. She'll be in conversation with Roy Eisenhart, who is a lecturer at UC Berkeley Law School. He's a distinguished member of the Commonwealth Club's California Book Jury. That's all I was supposed to say about him, but he's really a pretty fascinating and incredible human. He was former president of the A's, that little baseball team across the pond, and is a dedicated, I think, humanitarian, a deep thinker, and I know their conversation will be engaging and meaningful. So on behalf of all of us at the California Historical Society and the Commonwealth Club, it's truly a pleasure to have you here tonight. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I would also point out the A's represent the city that Jerry Brown was the mayor of, so... Right? Important connection. Well, Miriam, it's a pleasure to have you here. I'd point out that if you haven't read the Cesar Chavez book, I highly recommend it. It's a tremendous insight into that period of California history, of which, and Jerry Brown, of course, played a very active role in that that period of labor unrest in the Central Valley. We have the pleasure tonight of having several members of the Brown family here, and Miriam is going to quickly try to recognize them. If you get missed, please just stand up and shout out your name. Go ahead, Miriam.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great pleasure to be here and to be with you, and the book is about four generations, but we have a lot of fifth and sixth generation members of the Brown family here. So let me see, if doing in age order, Joe Kelly, who is Jerry's brother-in-law, and four of his children, Kathleen, Patricia, Cindy, and Joe. Did I get all that right? And then Hillary Armstrong, who is the daughter of Kathleen Brown, and her daughter, Catherine, and Catherine Casey, who is the granddaughter of Barbara Brown Casey, who is the oldest of Pat and Bernice's four children.
Okay.
You guys didn't warn me.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Sorry. So Kelly half, and Patrick Sheehan.
You're half the audience.
Yeah. There's a few seats up here, too.
Yeah. Let me say now, pardon my back. This room, it's impossible to look two directions at once, so forgive me. Yeah, thank you. My back is my better side anyway. So, Miriam, my favorite historical style of writing is the narrative form. And you, in this book, I think, are a terrific exponent of all the qualities that permits that style to develop storytelling over time. So I thought we'd respect that organization for your book and start at the beginning with August Shuckman.
That's how I got into this, so yeah. That seems fitting. August Shuckman is Jerry Brown's great-grandfather, and I became interested in doing the story of the Brown family because the governor was talking a lot about his great-grandfather. He was a Prussian immigrant who landed in New York in 1849. My claim to fame is that I found the record of the ship that he came on, which was called the Perseverance. His great-grandson really liked that a lot.
Yeah.
And August Shuckman crossed the plains in 1852 and settled in Colusa County, which is about an hour north of Sacramento. And we are really incredibly fortunate, both the family and historians and therefore the reading public, because August Shuckman kept a diary for part of his journey across the plains day by day that survived. He sent it back to Germany, and it eventually ended up back in California. So there's this, you know, the beginning of the book starts with his journey to California as a way of sort of looking at those early years of California. Mm-hmm. Because what attracted me to this story is that it's biography as history and history as biography, because the family's history, beginning with August Shuckman's arrival in 1852, almost exactly parallels the arc of statehood for California.
Yeah, I would say that's a quality of good biography, is it gives you not just the context of the person, but the context of the time.
Right.
And we're going to, as we go through our discussion tonight, think about the degree to which California shaped the Browns versus the Browns shaped California. It's probably both. What was the catalyst that brought you to the topic?
So it really was listening to Jerry Brown talk in speeches about his great-grandfather and the land that he had settled on in Colusa, which is the land on which the governor has built his retirement home, and he will be moving there in a few months. And so it was thinking about that arc and the idea that that land had stayed in the family for so many generations. Mm-hmm. And it's not, as most people know, you know, not a tourist attraction, not a place that most people think of being a typical retirement home. So his interest in that land as the ancestral home, which became tied up with his own passion for tracing his genealogy and finding relatives in Ireland and in Germany and staging family reunions. So that was sort of what got me hooked into it. Mm-hmm. And then from there, really, it was a conversation that I had with him in Colusa when there was nothing on the land at all, really, in which he talked about the importance of history and sort of sketched out his family history and talked about his father, mm-hmm. that I came away with that sort of sense of how this might be a way to tell a history of California through, you know, this very unique right. family.
So the book, you use the surnames Pat and Jerry.
I do.
Because it can get very confusing if you're constantly trying to identify which of the governors we're talking about at any particular time. But let's start with Pat.
Okay.
Would it draw us the line between August Shookman and Edmund G. Pat Brown?
August's youngest daughter, most of his children stayed in Colusa. There's still a lot of cousins up there in their 80s. But August Shookman's youngest daughter, Ida, was the outlier in the family. And as soon as she could, she got out of Colusa, because for reasons that anyone who's been in Colusa will understand. And she was the first in a long line of very smart, independent, really fiercely independent women in this family. She went to San Francisco when she was 18 and never went back, went to visit her sister, but refused to go to the Mountain House, scratched her picture, her face out on the picture when she was 15 on the Mountain House because she did not want anything to do with it. And she marries Edmund Joseph Brown, who was born in San Francisco in 1870. He is the son of Irish immigrants who fled from Tipperary during the potato famine and come to San Francisco, as so many did, for the opportunity and the openness that it represented at that time. So Edmund and Ida marry, and Pat is their oldest son.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to draw a contrast between Pat and Jerry, but before we do that, lay the foundation for how Pat moved from the upbringing that you describe into politics and his approach to being a politician.
Yeah, Pat used to say that he ran for president of every club even when he wasn't a member. and he was just this natural. It's funny because there's some wonderful, thanks to the family, there are wonderful old photos.
Right.
Pat's father was a sort of entrepreneur who was sort of alternately in the money and out of the money. But one of the things that he did was operate photo studios. So there are a lot of these posed photos. And you look at the little Pat Brown, or Edmund as he was at the right. time, and he just is like, looks like a little politician even then. he was just always attracted, loved being around people. It's fun. Now when I'm doing events for the book, I run into a lot of people, and there may be people in this room in this category who ran into Pat Brown at some point in their lives. You know, later on, I met Pat Brown in an elevator, and by the time we got to the top floor, he knew the names of everyone in the elevator, and we were all friends. And so he really, you know, was that classic old style politician mm-hmm. and seemed to want to be one from a very young age.
Yeah. And in these days, the center of gravity for politics in California was San Francisco. Right.
Right, absolutely.
So what was the first office that he ran for?
So Pat grew up in a Republican family. He was a Republican. His father was close to Tom Finn, the then Republican leader of San Francisco. And the first race he made, Pat was 23, and he challenged an incumbent Republican assemblyman. And his slogan was 23 years in the district. And I think he got like 500 votes or something. I mean, he just got creamed. And then in 1934, he became a Roosevelt Democrat. Mm-hmm. And the first office he was actually elected to was district attorney.
In San Francisco in
1943.
Hmm. Now, was he doing that because he was trying? That's not an uncommon career track. Do you think he had ascension up the political ladder in mind?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah, he was always, Joe Kelly, who's in the audience, gave me a great insight to Pat when he said that he didn't like people who smoked pipes because he thought they were too slow. He was always, you know, Pat was always in a hurry. He skipped college and went directly to night law school,
right,
partly for financial reasons, but also because he was always, you know, in a hurry to get to the next thing.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, he loved politics and he loved that world. He worked hard on Culbert Olson's campaign, who was... People may not remember Culbert Olson. He was one of only four Democrats elected governor in California since the 1800s. But so he was always kind of looking for the next step, and then eventually, you know, runs for attorney general and then governor.
State attorney general.
Yes.
Yeah. Which is an important step into the governorship.
And it's sort of worth remembering that California was a Republican state at that time. And when he wins the attorney general's race in 1950, he's the only Democrat. It's a big deal because he's the only Democrat elected to statewide office.
Was Earl Warren governor?
Yes.
Then? Yeah.
Yes. And they were close.
Yeah. But that says something about this state right there, right? I don't want to get off our timeline here too much, but the fact that the Republican governor and the Democratic attorney general were close.
Yeah.
That's unique almost to California.
I think so. And I think it's one of the things I try to do in the book is talk about what does make California unique. And we're getting a little off topic here, but as a former New Yorker for much of my life, I can say that I know what New Yorkers think about California. And I tried hard in this book to sort of reflect some of the things that make California different and interesting and much more complicated a place than people know. And that idea of the party of California and the relationships between Republicans and Democrats is an important piece of that.
That's what I just wanted to nail that there. If we start talking about baseball, we're off topic, but other than that, we're on topic. So what year was Pat Brown elected governor?
1958,
right.
It's really the resurgence. I mean, it's a major turning point for the Democratic Party in the state. It comes after... first of all, there was a system until the 60s of cross-filing. It's a little bit like what we have now, not quite, but Democrats and Republicans ran in each other's primaries. They were not even identified by party, so that the incumbents, at that point the Republicans, had this big advantage because they could run and sometimes win both party primaries. Earl Warren did when he was running for re-election. Yeah. So the Democrats were shut out and continue to be shut out in so many ways. In 1958, was a turning point because Pat was elected, but also because of the growth of the California Democratic Council, which people may remember, which sort of started and grew out of the Stevenson Clubs in the early 50s. It was an attempt to sort of rebuild the party through the grassroots, and Pat was the beneficiary of that.
This was still primarily in Northern California.
Very much so, right.
Yeah. 58 was a kind of a trending point for the country, too. I mean, Eisenhower was coming off his second term, and we were going to elect Kennedy, and so California just led the way there.
As usual. Right?
Yeah. When I think of Pat Brown as governor, I first think water project. Talk about his water project.
Pat Brown presides over California at this time of, you know, enormous expansion in the post-war years. You know, the statistic that I always use is that for almost a decade, an average of 1,000 people a day were moving to California and 1,000 babies were being born. So there's this need for infrastructure, for schools, for roads, and for water. And there had been a lot of attempts prior to his election to create a state water project that would supplement the Central Valley Water Project, which was run by the federal government. For all the same reasons that we see fights over water now, you know, the water is in the north and the people were in the south and the agricultural land was in the Central Valley. It was very hard to get political agreement. And he was able in his first year to do that, to push through a deal that created, you know, what we now know as the State Water Project. And it was, you know, the biggest public works project in the country's history at the time. And both of sort of financial and engineering, you know, marvel. And then kind of just the reading about the efforts to get the move water over the Tehachapi Mountains. Mm-hmm. They were going to use a nuclear reactor at one point to do it. And, you know, and it was, but it was also an era when you could do this, but there was no environmental movement.
Right.
There was no CEQA. So he was able to sort of push this through. But, you know, it was also with the help of Republicans when not only did it have to pass the legislature, but the bond issue, which was a $1.75 billion bond, again, the largest, you know, public works project in history at the time, had to be passed by, you know, by the voters. And it was the Republican mayor of Los Angeles who, of course, you know, whose constituents stood to benefit from this, but who was really instrumental in helping to get that passed. Mm-hmm.
Did he identify that early, before he was running for office?
Yes, he did. And he was really interested in, there were a lot of water issues that he dealt with as attorney general.
Yeah.
So he sort of came in with that background. Mm-hmm. And an interest sort of, I mean, I think this says a lot about both the times and about Pat Brown, that part of the reason he was able to succeed where others had failed is that he didn't view this as a fight over a scarce resource. Perhaps he should have, but he did not. What he said was, there's plenty of water for everyone. It's just a question of how you get it from here to there. And he really also, you know, in his own way, was farsighted in saying that you had to do this in order to allow Southern California to develop, that without water, I mean, you know, obviously there is an environmental argument that one should not have provided the water for people, but his argument was they're going to come whether or not there's water, and we need to provide it.
Yeah. And this was post-World War II, when California at this point was growing
unbelievably fast.
Exponentially.
Yeah.
The other thing I think of when you mentioned Pat Brown's name, I don't mean to be so informal, but is the University of California system.
I think this is another kind of remarkable achievement of his, and also something that is so unique to California and has shaped California in so many ways. You know, again, coming from New York, there is no university system, there's no system of public higher education remotely comparable to California's anywhere in the country. The three systems, the university and the Cal States and the community colleges. And he comes in, because of all the growth you were just describing, he comes into office at this moment where there's all this friction between the systems, and the Cal States want to be able to have graduate programs. They want the kind of constitutional independence that the universities have. And he is able to kind of help with the with great assistance from Clark Kerr, who is the chancellor of the system, to push through the master plan for higher education, which parenthetically was subtitled 1960 to 1975. It has not yet been updated since then, so, and it's probably badly in need of it. But, but you know, during Pat Brown's tenure, there were three whole campuses, Irvine, Santa Cruz, and San Diego, that are created. And, you know, from scratch, just like that.
Right.
And he loved, because partly he did not go to college, he would talk about my university, and he particularly loved the Cal campus where his wife went as a precocious 14-year-old. She entered college.
We could give her a name, Bernice.
Bernice Lane, who was, again, another one of the brilliant women in the Brown family. And many, many of you guys went to Cal, so we have. And he would talk about my university, and it really, it, you know, meant a lot to him.
Yeah, I went to Cal and law school during his term as governor, which dates me, but anyway. And the tuition was $50 per semester. Now, that's changed, obviously, for a lot of reasons. But to me, that was, that I ascribed that freeness of the education here to him. I mean, I remember personally feeling thankful to the governor because it struck me that was his doing.
And it went back to, and for me in the book, Cal is almost a character, or that's how I thought mm-hmm. of it, because it's so important, again, you know, in the formation of California, and it starts so early. I mean, it's in the first constitution, right. The idea that there should be a commitment to free mm-hmm. higher education. And the other, you know, important thing about the master plan is that it represented a commitment to universal access to education. Right. And California, again, was very early in doing something that the rest of the country, you know, ultimately embraced as well. And he, you know, very much embraced right. that.
It was
a little bit unlike, we can get to later, a little bit unlike his son, but that's...
Well, we are going to go there because I in the interest of time, I'd say during the time that Pat was governor, what was Jerry doing?
Jerry was in the seminary.
Right.
Jerry went to St. Ignatius, went to Jesuit high school, went to Santa Clara, the oldest college in California, for a year, and then went into the seminary for 3.5 years. So from 56 to 1960. So for part of the time his father was governor,
right.
he was finished at Cal and then mm-hmm. went to law school. But he spent 3.5 years there and took his vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. And as his mother said, that they were all, no one was surprised that the vow that he had trouble keeping was obedience.
Develop that further for
yeah.
us.
Well, he was viewed, there's great, there the Jesuits keep wonderful records and they have archives, and in the archives there is various correspondence and letters from the rector to his superiors in which they are concerned about the troublemaker among the juniors who is stirring things up and raising questions about what he can and can't read and yeah. about various other things. And so when he comes in to say that he wants to be relieved of his vows, they're very happy to see him go. and there's a great line that I can't quote quite verbatim, but it goes something like this, where that he says that he doesn't have trouble obeying the rules. He has trouble obeying them because he is told to. And the word nonconformist comes yeah, up there somewhere yeah. too. So I think his character then was quite consistent.
How would you compare, I mean, at this time, of course, he's probably, 23 or so, doesn't matter. He's still in his rebellious years. How would you compare him and his parents? I mean, were they...
You know, he always said, and his mother always said, and others say that he was much more like his mother. Mm-hmm. His mother was, you know, quite brilliant and very frugal. She takes credit for passing on the frugal / cheap gene to her son. And she was also, you know, much more private person, not gregarious and ebullient like Pat Brown was, much more of an introvert. So, you know, he takes on after her in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. But he clearly got the political gene.
Right.
She was not political, never wanted to be involved in politics particularly, and he certainly got that mm-hmm. from his father, as he now readily admits and embraces.
So how does his ascension into politics come about?
He goes to Yale Law School, comes back, clerks for a year at the Supreme Court, and then moves to Los Angeles very deliberately because that, you were saying how the political center was yeah. San Francisco, and by the 60s it shifts south. It's one of the reasons that Pat Brown ultimately loses to Ronald Reagan in 1966. So Jerry, when he starts his legal career, moves to Los Angeles because he's already decided, although he doesn't talk about it, mm-hmm. that he's going to run for office, and that's where, you know, the votes are. So he does kind of a couple years in a law firm there, and really enters politics through the anti-Vietnam War movement. His first political activity as in, you know, on his own is as a delegate for Eugene McCarthy in 1968. And actually, even before McCarthy enters the race, he's on what was called the Peace Slate, which was also the CDC created, again, leading the country and sort of saying, we're going to commit to supporting a candidate who will oppose the war. And so he gets involved with McCarthy's campaign. And McCarthy is an interesting political role model for him, very different than his father. And then in 1969, he runs for the Los Angeles Community College Board, which was formed in that year. There were 140 candidates. He places first, and although his he was known his entire life as Jerry because his mother did not like the name Edmund. But when he runs for office, he runs as Edmund G. Brown Jr.
And I wonder why.
Overwhelmingly elected in 69. And then by 1970, he runs for and is elected Secretary of State.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
We talked about the Attorney General before. Is Secretary of State a track position?
Well, you know, it had not been, as it turns out, yes, but it had not, would not be. It was
at that time.
At that time, it was not. I mean, it was another sort of
dead end.
Total. There were only two people who had had the office for, like, I don't remember how many years, Frank M. Jordan and Frank something else Jordan, who was his son. And, you know, it was a complete dead end job where, and, but, it was the office that was open that he, you know, was, he's very good and strategic as he was when he ran for mayor in Oakland and seeing where there's an opportunity. And that was something he could run for. So he did. And then once he made that decision, he sort of researched the law and saw that the Secretary of State's office had control over campaign finance. And suddenly campaign finance became an issue. And ultimately, as Secretary of State, he helped to really wrote, or his staff wrote, what becomes the Political Reform Act of 1974, which is on the ballot when he runs for governor. And his timing, again, you know, Pat Brown had a saying that, you know, timing is everything. And certainly Jerry benefited from Watergate, which is happening right around then. But all of the things that are the fair political FPPC, Fair Political Practices Commission is created out of the legislation that he writes as Secretary of State. And he sort of takes on the political establishment in all of this. People were not reporting where their money was coming from. So candidates would just say, you know, $50 from a friend and so forth. And none of that mattered a lot until television became a factor because people weren't spending that much on campaigns. But suddenly in the 1970s, you get the need to raise a lot of money. And so the idea of transparency and campaign finance and finance limits and so forth becomes a, you know, a popular issue for him to run on.
And gave him this sense of a progressive feeling.
Yes, and very much being the new, he was young, he was doing that. He support 18-year-olds got the right to vote, and he was active in sort of, you know, legislating. There was a big fight over whether you could vote on your where you went to college as opposed to where you lived, and he took the side of the students. And there are, in his files, in his papers, which are at the University of Southern California, there are just files of press releases that he issued as Secretary of State. It's like one a week. I mean, they were just like, you know, he was, he made maximum use of that office.
Which showed a kind of a political genius in much different way than his dad. Both of them were political geniuses in their own way. Jerry struck me as much more strategic. Or strikes me. So he becomes governor in 1975?
Yes, he elected in 74, takes office in 75.
Who did he run against? I don't remember. It doesn't matter, maybe.
You're gonna ask me.
But he was the youngest. The point is, he was the youngest governor.
He was. He was 36. He was the youngest governor that anybody could think of in California history. And as we know, he's also the oldest governor in California.
And the longest governor now, right? What else? What have we left out? One of the smartest governors in California history also. So if we think back and remember that period until end of the 70s, one of the issues was Proposition 13.
Yes.
What position did he take on that?
Proposition 13 is on the ballot in June of 78, which is the year he's running for re-election in mm-hmm. November. And, you know, he did not have a great relationship with the legislature at that point in time. He'd already run for president in 76 and was gearing up to run again in 1980.
Yeah.
And that's relevant because as this big surplus is piling up in the state and as property taxes are increasing and the mm-hmm. whole property tax revolt is building, the legislature and the governor are really quite late to formulate any kind of alternative to Prop 13, which, you know, is this sort of meat axe approach to tax reform.
But very populist.
Very, you know, and so he, like almost every other elected official, opposed Prop 13 and supported what was their alternative, which was Prop 8, which never had much of a chance at all. It didn't offer nearly the same benefits. So he opposed it. But as soon as it passed, he turned around and embraced it wholeheartedly, much to the dismay of his father, actually, who felt that he should be much more somehow impassioned against it and against what its impact was going to be. But he needed to get reelected. And in order to get reelected, he needed to embrace Prop 13. And so he did. Became called Jerry Jarvis by some of the more liberal folks. And in fact, Jarvis did, a commercial for him after Prop 13 passed.
But at the time, I mean, if we think back, I don't think we saw the full impact of Prop 13 when it was enacted. I mean, nobody ran out a spreadsheet for the next 25 years and what this was going to do to education and so forth. So you commented before about the difference in his point of view about tuition at the University of California. So I want to go back and pick that up.
Well, in the interim, in the 8 years that Reagan was governor, he was not particularly kind to the university, and in fact tuition wasn't called tuition, it was called a fee, I guess, but in effect tuition begins under Reagan. And so when Jerry's elected, there's a, you know, a sense or an expectation that he will reverse that and be the kind of champion of the university that his father was, and he wasn't. And that's a complicated issue. I think part of it is to put in context the idea that he comes into office in 75 really to just shake up the status quo in general, and the university is part of that. You know, this is not his father's government. And all the people who thought they were going to be back in power because they were Pat's pals were in for something different. And you know, he had a very different vision of what government should look like. He appoints women to all sorts of jobs that they had not had before, really changes the complexion of the judiciary in significant ways.
Yeah, appointed the first woman Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
Correct. And the first Latino and the first Black on the Supreme Court. And in terms of the university, he wanted also to shake things up and put people on the regents who were rather controversial. Gregory Bateson, who is a sort of brilliant, eclectic British anthropologist who taught at the University of Santa Cruz, explained to Jerry that he thought that the university was wasted on all but about 10% of the students. And Jerry put him on the regents. You know, there are these great transcripts of these regents meetings that are just like, so there's a lot. And then he most famously said that instead of getting a pay raise, that the faculty should accept that they were getting psychic income from teaching at the university. There are a lot, you know, there are academics I know who to this day, you know, hold that against him in a very big way. And he's tried to be somewhat different in his relationship this time, but he had a very antagonistic relationship with them.
Well, you're right that it started under Reagan, that's for sure.
But he did not act to correct it in any way.
No. Just to frame it, today, I went there, it cost $50. Today it costs $50,000, $5,000 a year to go to law school. So it is no longer what we would call free public education.
Right. Although I would say just that the University of California is still, to me, I mean, I write about the university in the present day because I think it continues to function as both an economic engine for the state and most importantly, sort of an avenue of upward mobility.
Right.
And for a very different population now, and the university is really trying to adjust to that. So 43% of the students at the University of California today are the first generation in their family to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
And even though the tuition is whatever, you know, 12,000 or something,
yeah.
there's a significant percentage who do not pay tuition because of Cal Grants and other financial aid. So, you know, it's not what it was, but it still is a really important institution.
Still, by most ratings, the finest public university in the
nation. And also in the sort of calculations of what public universities are able to move people into the middle class, all of the campuses rank really high.
Okay, I'm sensitive to time because I want to leave time for audience questions. So he terms out as governor, and he turns around and runs for mayor of Oakland.
Right. In between, we have the wilderness years. He doesn't like that expression, from 82 when he loses for Senate until 1998 when he runs for mayor of Oakland, he does various things, but they're all sort of trying to find a way back into politics. I mean, he's never that far away. Mm-hmm. He runs his state party. He runs for president in 92 with his 1-800 number. And then after that, after he loses, after the presidential campaign, which was We the People starts there, he then forms a commune in Oakland. It's We the People organization, and begins to sort of lay the groundwork for running for mayor because, again, it's something he can do. Oakland is in a very bad spot at that time. He's embraced as the celebrity mayor. He's able to bring developers and bring attention to Oakland that it had not had.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, sees that as a way back, and it turns out
to be. And he did a great job. So the cycle keeps going, and he becomes governor again. Now, how do you think the experience of being on the ground, running a city, affected his second two terms as governor?
I think it was really important. When I talked to lots of people about sort of Jerry 1 versus Jerry 2, what was different, the two things everyone says immediately are Anne and Oakland.
Mm-hmm. Anne being his wife.
Being his wife. They were married in 2005 when he starts to run for attorney general. And in Oakland, I mean, that experience that he skipped altogether because of coming in at such a high level as a state official, of seeing how laws play out on the ground,
right.
I think is a major thing, and particularly in terms of his positions in criminal justice, you know, where there's a very strong tie to what he sees in Oakland and a lot of real reversals, I mean, really 180-degree reversals of positions that he held the first time around.
And Oakland is really a neighborhood-based city, so that's a form of populism that I think he would have resonated with. That's my projection, but he would have felt very comfortable in it.
Well, and it's interesting, I mean, he would walk around the streets of Oakland and talk to people, sort of much in some ways as his father did in a different way.
Yeah.
And although he's a very different personality, clearly, he was interested in, you know, when he focuses on something, he focuses very intently on it. And it's when he focused on the issue of recidivism, particularly in Oakland and all the people who were coming out and this sort of cycle of people coming out of prison and then just going right back and how to try to address that. I think that became, you know, a big focus.
Well, in no way can we do justice to this book by sitting here for 45 minutes talking about it, but I think you've gotten a sense of the narrative power and the research that Miriam has done. And when we think of it, what was it, aggregate 24 years that the two of them were Pat and Jerry were governor?
24 years as governor, yeah. And then, you know, 8 years between them, yeah, as attorney general. And we also should, just before we finish, mention Kathleen Brown, please, who had her own political, right, career also,
yeah,
was state treasurer for 4 years, mm-hmm, and then, you know, sort of famously ran, yeah, against Pete Wilson in Prop 187, that whole.
So as we said, yeah, starting off, it's a book about the Browns, but that is a book about California, because this family has been so formative in designing the state that we have today, which is the fourth or fifth, depending on how you count, largest economy in the world. Just think of it. He should be an ambassador to the United Nations.
Well, and he never got to be president, but he, in effect, in some ways, is...
Right. Larger.
Certainly a world leader at this point on climate change.
And that book is still being written.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I'm going to surrender my sole post here of asking questions. And I'm going to ask that we go to the microphone. And we have about 15 minutes, so we can get quite a few questions in. Nobody ever wants to go first, right? So here, there we go.
So I'd like to remind everyone online and on the radio that they are listening to Roy Eisenhardt interviewing Miriam Powell, the author of a book on the Brown family dynasty and how it affected California.
Thank you very much for this wonderful book. My question is about Edmund Brown. We know that he did an amazing job creating the university system. You didn't mention the highway system, right, which I think was a huge feat. And then we have the water project. And as I look at those three, and I'm interested in your opinion, the water project had a major impact on the Delta, and the pumps have had a major impact on the fish. That hasn't been very positive. So what do you think about how that could have been different, or what do you think about the way it has actually evolved today?
The Delta is a, you know, as you know, a really complicated ecosystem. And part of the state water project that never, the piece of the water state water project that never was completed was the peripheral canal, which under Jerry Brown's first tenure in Sacramento, that referendum was also defeated in 1982, and we now have the tunnels, which are sort of the latest iteration of that. So, you know, it's beyond my expertise to the, I mean, I've read a lot about it. It's a really complicated environmental issue. I don't, you know, there are people on who know far more about it that are on many sides of it, but certainly that was a piece of what was envisioned as the original project, was some sort of way to get around the pumps in the Delta.
Your book goes through several generations of a family, goes through, as you've noted, one of the largest economies in the world and how it has grown up through that time. Your book seems to encompass so much. What do you hope people will take away from it when they read it?
I hope that people will take away a much more nuanced understanding of California as a place and the things that make it important and the things that make it different. And I just was on the East Coast for a week, and I sort of say to people, and they all agree, it's like in the East Coast, people think of California either as a dystopian disaster that's about to, you know, like, how could you possibly live there with earthquakes and fires, or a utopian, you know, oh my God, you have Jerry Brown, isn't it wonderful? Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, as people who live here understand, it's really a lot more complicated than that. And what I tried to identify in the book are those themes that make California different and special. And the family is a way to illustrate them, because whether it is an attachment to the environment, which we haven't really talked about, but, you know, Pat Brown grew up going to Yosemite and the Russian River every summer as a kid, brought his family there, that sort of the importance of the natural world, and then Jerry's environmental record, which goes back to his first term, or the importance of immigrants and immigration, and from its earliest years, and this sort of sense that California, in the wake of the gold rush, when it becomes a state so quickly, it is a state from the beginning of immigrants from around the world, and immigrants have always been, you know, sometimes a flashpoint, sometimes in ugly ways in terms of Prop 187 or the Chinese Exclusion Act, but always immigrants have been an issue here, and higher education. And so, you know, there are a few other, but that sort of sense of what are the things that make California, you know, different and that give it an identity. And this family is so tied to that identity and has made it so much their own and vice versa, that for me, that was a vehicle to use people to tell that story. And that's what I want people to take away from it.
Give it to people who live in New York to read. That's the real
audience. We're trying, yeah.
Yes.
Thanks very much. I really want to go an earlier part of the discussion in the book, where you really sort of show the dynamic of the relationship that Pat had with Chavez, but then at the same time, you're stating that Pat had 78% of vote of the white. So there must be some kind of mechanism in which he was able to get the Mexican on board and the white. So what was the other side of this story? How could he integrate all these effectively?
Pat, another sort of through stream for the family that goes back to Ida Shuckman Brown, Pat's mother. She was a very strong believer in civil rights. She lived, the family lived in a three-story house in the Western Addition. The other families who lived in the apartments were Jewish. Pat went to school with a lot of Jewish kids at Lowell, including Norton Simon, for example, who became a friend and an early supporter. And Pat actually formed his own fraternity, an ecumenical fraternity in high school, because the fraternities wouldn't allow his Jewish friends to join. So that sense, and his mother was involved with the Unitarian Church. They had a relationship with a temple. She brought her kids there. So he grows up with a very strong sense of the importance of civil rights and hires the first Black assistant district attorney when he's San Francisco DA, and also, and then brings him into state government as well. So there was a sense in which he I think what you're referring to in terms of Chavez is that he did some things to support the what was the sort of the early stages of the farm worker movement, and then also gave, he always said that one of his proudest moments was giving non-citizens who were older Mexican-Americans, who were longtime residents, the right to state pensions, and that was something he felt was just, so it's that sense of, I think, sort of a clear moral sense, which is also, something that father and son have in common, really, and, you know, exercise it in different ways, but that idea that there is just sort of things that are morally right and that you do the right thing. Kathleen, an example of that, I always think in terms of Prop 187, where she, despite the fact that it was certainly not doing her candidacy any good, stood up very strongly and very early when a lot of other Democrats didn't against Prop 187, because she said, no daughter of Pat Brown could ever, not take this position and let that be my legacy. So it's a little bit of a complicated answer, but, issues of race and ethnicity are complicated.
You spoke in the first answer, I think, to your first question was the status of California, I guess, following the war and the development of California that was going on, and how successful Pat Brown was in managing that operation in all the ways that he did. How would you compare the time now and the job that Jerry Brown is doing in trying to keep California as a leader in the many ways that it was in the 50s, now in the 50 years later?
So it's hard to compare the times in a way, I think, because for two reasons. I mean, one, which I say in the book, is sort of, I don't feel I try not to pass judgment on things that are going on right now because I'm a historian and I approach, you know, there's with the perspective of time and history, you can really see there are things that there are initiatives that Jerry Brown has done, for example, in terms of changing the way education is funded, which are very significant. How that's going to play out and what the impact is, I think it's too soon to be able to say. So I do think, I mean, the things I would say to that are that clearly you see, particularly, you know, at this moment in time, given what's happening in the federal government, that California is sort of very much maintaining its position as a defender of certain principles and, again, certain moral values. I think that if you look at the speech that he gave, the State of the State address that the governor gave right after the president's inauguration, it was one of his sort of most powerful speeches in terms of immigrants and the rights of immigrants and defending people who are here, no matter what their status. So I think that he is sort of and that's a big part of what California is today. And also clearly on the environmental front, you know, all of the efforts to defend California's right historically to regulate air and water and other environmental issues to a greater degree than the federal government. So I think that his role in sort of trying to carve out those or continue those parts of the California legacy are very clear. I think it's hard to compare the results of something that's going on now to something that happened so far in the past.
Thank you. This has been really interesting. You mentioned the impact that his wife, Jerry's wife, has had on him. I wonder if you could expound a little bit about that.
Sure. And any family members who are here, feel free to jump in. You know, Anne Gus Brown is a remarkable woman in her own right. She is certainly his intellectual equal and has been his partner in ways that are quite remarkable. And, you know, they were married. As she quit her job and took on being his campaign manager when he ran for attorney general, and she has been his chief advisor in formal and informal positions ever since then, I think it's sort of a tribute to her ability to do that, that that's not resented in the way that you would expect often the role of a spouse to be. Instead, I think that people appreciate that she is able to provide a structure. So he talks about his mother this way in a eulogy that he gave when Bernice Brown died. He said, "She always provided the structure that enabled me to go and sort of, you know, bounce around." That's not quite how he said it, but that I knew that there was that safety net there, kind of. And he is somebody who is very committed to structure in a lot of ways and to tradition. And I think that, you know, she has provided that kind of structure and focus, and that people who work with him appreciate it. And they seem to have, you know, kind of a remarkable personal and professional partnership.
What was her profession?
She was a lawyer. She had a. She comes from a Republican political family in Michigan. Her father ran for lieutenant governor at one point. She came to California, went to Stanford Law School. She was on the verge of becoming a partner in a corporate law firm, mm-hmm. and quit because she didn't like it, and then went to work for The Gap, mm-hmm. and was really kind of mentored by the Fisher family, mm-hmm. Donald Fisher, and right. became the I forget her. She was the chief counsel and a senior, official at The Gap, right. and right. then quit that job and went to
married
Jerry. Yeah.
I asked that to bring out that side of her because she's certainly
a very accomplished yeah.
person.
You answered my question actually. I just previously a little bit, but I wondered in, as you saw Jerry Brown's interaction with the state agencies in California. When California is taking positions like contrary to the federal government on air pollution or immigration, et cetera, is he in there? Is he involved in the nitty gritty with them, or is he just more giving general guidance?
Oh yeah. I think one of the things that people who work with him have said, and that I've seen myself on some occasions, is, I mean, he is someone who gets very, very deep down into the details of issues, and one of the sort of unusual things about him, I think, is that he is able to get down in the weeds and to really do that and then come back up and sort of present it to people. So if you talk to people who have worked with him on complicated negotiations and issues, that's a really striking thing, that he's very good at negotiating. And part of the reason is because he can really sort of master the details of something, but then be able to step back and present it sort of at the 10,000 feet level. Most people can do one or the other, but, you know, it's more unusual. But I think he, you know, he has always, he, in one conversation I had with him, and we were talking about different people, and someone name came up, and he said, I have a very eclectic group of friends. And I said, yeah, but they all have a common denominator. You know, they're all really smart. And that's what he's attracted. I mean, he's always surrounded himself and sought out people. He likes to call people. I mean, he's, you know, famous and notorious in some circles for wanting to call people up about issues that, you know, experts from wherever that he finds them. It's really interesting to read his veto messages, which he just finished doing bill signing, because they're often, you know, they have interesting quotes in them. And there's a story in the book from his first go round where there was a bill about whether to allow the importation to California of turtle meat from this endangered turtle in the Bahamas. And he called all these people and spent hours, you know, much to the frustration of his staff who were trying to get him to focus on other issues, before ultimately deciding to write the veto message. So he does like to get into the details.
Well, I got moved out here from New York, and my first, and it was in 2000. And my first glimpse of California politics was Willie Brown was running for re-election of mayor of San Francisco, and everyone who was running against him was to the left of him. And that was my first sign that California was different. And then Jerry Brown, a former governor, was mayor of Oakland, right? And I somehow got an invitation to one of his State of the City speeches. He used to give a State of the City speech in Oakland as mayor. And just to show his consistency, first of all, you said he seemed very comfortable in Oakland, Roy, and I thought he was a fish out of water in this thing. There were like three or four different local political union groups, and he looked like a Jesuit, you know, speaking at, you know, at a university talking. But one of the things he said he's now done, which is he talked about recidivism, saying we have this new program for dealing with people as they come back to Oakland. He said, I call it my come to Jesus moment for them, that you send a little group out to each person that came back,
right,
saying, we know you're here. He says, I don't know if this will do any good. He was just thinking out loud, I don't know if this will do any good. But then he said, you know, maybe the final solution to this is simply that, you know, once they're 44 years old, their testosterone will go down and we won't have to worry about them anymore. Let them out of jail once they're 44, and it'll save the state money. And it was that kind of speech that made it very clear he wasn't the normal politician.
Right.
So there's time for one more question. Anybody like to ask the last question? Anybody from the family would like to ask a question? We have a question. Did you interview the people from the family too? Yes.
So a remarkable book. Thanks very much for writing it. Thanks. So my question is, Jerry can be tough to talk to sometimes and maybe a tough interview. So did you learn a technique to... Yeah, have them open up of sorts and really get them to expound on things?
Something for the good of his family members, I think.
So, you know, because in the book, I don't quote people in out of time. So, you know, all of the quotes are taken from historic documents and for things that were said at the time that I'm writing about. That being relevant, because I wasn't looking to quote him, you know, other than if I was writing about the very recent past, but in sort of discussing with him anything that was before, you know, that was historic. And I think partly because of that, I mean, what I was interested in is how his mind worked. And therefore, we had, you know, any number of very non-linear conversations, which you would be familiar with, all of you. And that was great for me, that was really helpful because I wanted to see how he made associations. And, you know, the fact that he brought up Sheldon Wolin in every conversation made me want to know who Sheldon Wolin was, one of his professors at Berkeley. And I also tried to, I mean, I started out by saying that I was going to try to not ask him anything he'd answered already 100 times. And I think that was the other thing that was helpful to me was that I didn't actually talk to him for the first two years after my one long conversation with him when I was starting to try to figure out what I was doing. I didn't talk to him for 2 years. And during that time, I talked to other people, but I also spent a lot of time in archives of different sorts. And, you know, partly because I didn't want to waste his time. And there's so much information that's available. And I also kind of knew that the more I knew when I talked to him, the better it was going to be, and the more likely he was going to be to respond or to say something that would be more useful to me. So I think that I guess the only sort of tactic that I had was to be as informed as possible. You know, so we would have these very, and I found him very amusing, very entertaining. I mean, he's very funny. He has a very dry sense of humor. And so we would have these conversations like, and the other thing is that he's, from my point of view, was very helpful, was that he is, unlike his father, sort of into, I'm not telling stories. I want, you know, no embellishment. You know, he, when he read the first version of the final version of the book, he thought I had overemphasized his role on the high school debate club. And we had a whole discussion about what his role really was. But that for me, I mean, it's, I guess this is just sort of my journalism background as an interviewer. It's like, okay, so well, why was the debate club important for you? And, you know, that allowed me to sort of elicit more information. And then a bunch of conversations would also be like, so the story about the time that, you know, for example, his father would tell this story, and his mother too, a little bit about, there was a time on his birthday in high school where he was late for his surprise birthday party because it was Holy Thursday, and he was going, the story was that he was going to every church and to see how many churches he could go to. And so I was like, is that story true? And he said, well, not exactly. I only went to one church. I didn't go to a lot of churches. I just went to St. Brendan. And I went to St. Brendan because I like the this and was the whole. So again, it was sort of like how to play off of what he, you know, what I knew, I guess, is essentially the case. But, you know, he was kind of remarkable. And I mean, I covered a lot of politicians in New York, and he's unusual in many ways, but one of them that he was not, didn't attempt to really control what I was doing. So for the 2 years that I was out there, I mean, I know people told him that they were talking to me, and some people asked him before they did. And again, you know, a lot of what I did was in archives, but he didn't sort of try to control that or in any way, which to me was very helpful.
Well, thank you very, very much, Mary Monroy.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you, Marianne.
Thank you. That was great.
And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 116th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.